This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
This week on Hangar Talk, flying around the world with no emissions.
And the FAA aims for safer runways.
Colorado tries to scuttle a lead report.
And the gamma numbers are good, Ian. We crossed 4,000 deliveries for the first time in 10 years.
That's fantastic. Also, we gave away an airplane, David.
We did, Ian. We're going to hear more about that. Are you ready to do some hangar talk?
Let's do it.
From AOPA, your freedom to fly. This is Hangar Talk.
1056, turn right, heading 130, contact final 132.4.
Turn right, contact.
With your hosts, Ian Twombly and David Tulitz. This is Hangar Talk.
Welcome to Hangar Talk, everybody. I'm Ian Twombly.
And I'm David Tulitz.
David, lots of fun stuff to get to today. Later on, of course, one of those things is our guest. That's Dick Braun. Dick is a producer, filmmaker who has a big interest in flying boats and made a movie about them.
Right on. And we're going to hear more about that. I got to meet him out in Malibu at his gallery. It's Dirk Braun, B-R-A-U-N, gallery.com, by the way. And Alicia Heron did the interview. It was great. He's a really cool guy. And he's a Cessna 182 pilot as well.
Okay, cool. So we'll hear from him later on. First, let's talk about Impulse. That's what a new project from the Solar Impulse folks, that's what they're calling. And the goal is to fly around the world completely on hydrogen power with zero emissions.
Yeah, Bertrand Piccard, who we have reported on in the past, he's a Swiss explorer. He has circumnavigated the Earth by balloon and solar-powered airplane, as you mentioned.
Yep, Solar Impulse. This
is, Solar Impulse. So this is his next project. So, Ian, you did a little bit of reporting. I always lean on you when we talk about hydrogen-powered aircraft because you wrote one of the first stories that I read here at AOPA. What do you think about hydrogen power and circumnavigating the globe that way?
Well, I think it's exciting. I mean, you know, it's kind of the only frontier that's left, right? I was thinking about that earlier, about how these circumnavigation records, they've all kind of been done, right? Speed records and altitude and all that sort of thing. We don't get terribly excited about them anymore. And so really the only frontier that's left is technology. And Picard's place, that's, of course, the Solar Impulse, where he did it just by sun power. And then this is going to be hydrogen. And it's really good for public attention. I mean, he's based, you know, he's Swiss, he's based in Europe. They're getting European support from people like Airbus and Dahar and stuff like that. And so, obviously, climate being a big issue over there.
It really is.
Yeah. So, I don't know. There's lots of things to work out. You know, there are obviously commercial projects that are working on hydrogen. Basic idea being that it's, you know, kind of electric power plant driven by a hydrogen fuel cell. So, you know, you safely carry that much hydrogen.
That's what I worry about. And how do you refill it and things like that?
Exactly.
They've already had 2 years of research, development, and design, and there's some heavy hitter names involved in this project.
Yeah.
Airbus, Dyer, and others. It's got some pretty unique support from the higher ups.
Yeah, they'll do it. I mean, there's no question to me they're going to be successful. I mean, they've been successful in the past, so that'll be cool to watch and exciting to watch. I really enjoyed watching Solar Impulse. I thought it was fantastic. So excited for them to do that.
It was. It was really cool. And I reported a little bit on that back when I was working mainly for online.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. And there were updates all the time. And they had a really good website, too. So very cool stuff.
Yep. So we want to talk a little bit about runway safety. I know, really exciting topic.
Well, it's a really important topic. That's for sure.
It is important. Yeah, it is. It's been a focus for the FAA in recent years. A new story that Lily wrote for us about this talks. It's kind of dual focused. One is the FAA did a survey about runway guard lights. Those are at the Holt short line. Maybe you've seen them. And the other part of this was something I had never heard of. And one of the reasons that we want to talk about this today, and that is these AAMs.
Yeah, you brought that up to me, Ian. That was really interesting. And we dove into that page on the FAA site. And the AAN, that's the arrival alert notices. And they're at several airports with a history of misalignment risk. And by that, we mean a lot of these airports have maybe parallel runways. You mentioned something offline that is something also for us to look out for. That is taxiways that are very wide taxiways that used to be runways.
Used to be runways, exactly.
And they're confusing if you're not familiar with the airport. And so it leads to a lot of confusion on the runway during approaches, and really also, and we've heard about some tragic incidents on departures as well.
Yeah, that's right.
And you and I both have some personal experience with this. So the AANs, that's really interesting.
Yeah, these are cool. So I, like I said, I didn't even know these things were around. They're out there for 40 airports, presumably ones where the FAA think there's the highest risk. They basically, it's kind of a photo from final, and it identifies what the runway is, what the taxiway is, kind of what to watch out for. It's funny because, you know, a lot of times you, of course, it seems obvious, you know, when you're sitting on the ground, you're like, of course that's the runway, and of course that's the taxiway. But you know how it is. It's like you go in some places and maybe it all, you know, we get these cues of like surface condition, right? Like we think, okay, the runway maybe is concrete. It's going to have some tire marks on it. Obviously, there's only a yellow stripe on the taxiway, but it's like, especially some of these, like I said, decommissioned runways used as taxiways. I mean, you can still see the markings of the previous runway on it. You know, they're faded out or whatever, and that can be dangerous.
Yeah, it is. And the FAA uses, as an example, Tucson Runway 30 and Taxiway Alpha. And they are just as wide. One is just as wide as the other. You could easily confuse that. That to me is something that we really need to think more about. You know, I learned to fly in Atlanta at Peachtree DeKalb Airport, and there were parallel runways. One was much shorter than the other and much wider, but nonetheless, it was a common theme for a pilot to say they were going to land on the right side runway, and then they landed on the left, or vice versa. And that could lead, honestly, that could lead to some disastrous results.
Yeah.
But so many wrong surface events actually did, I don't know if you knew this, Ian, they occurred during the daytime and in visual meteorological conditions.
You know what? It makes sense.
Yeah. I guess you're right.
Yeah, it makes sense, because if it's IMC, you're going to have the localizer in, and if it's night,
right,
you're
going
to have blue lights for the taxiway and white for the runway, right? So yeah, easier to discern.
Good point. Yeah. And the pilot has read back the correct landing clearance. So, you know, and that might go more to the expectations that we get. You know, sometimes we recite things by rote and expect a certain clearance or expect a certain runway. And we say, Roger, and read it back correctly.
Yeah.
When really it's different instructions.
Yeah. Yep, that's right. So check those out. Arrival alert notices, pretty neat. And if they have one for your airport or where you're going to go, more likely, I mean, if you're at your home airport, you probably know it, but if it's somewhere you're going to go, it's definitely worth just giving it a quick look.
8 airports in California, 5 in Arizona, and just before we leave, in Payne Field was a surprising one for me in Washington State.
Yeah. So lead, we know it's an issue right now. We're trying to get the lead out of avgas. We're all on board with that, right? We all know about this,
right?
Of course, some of the things that we're fighting now are states that are trying to they're jumping the gun, right?
Uh-huh.
So California, they used a flawed study of lead exposure as one of the bases to be able to do that. Colorado,
oh my goodness,
actually commissioned a lead study as well. They looked at a number of different areas near GA airports. And found nothing.
No.
Nothing. No lead exposure. No detectable lead exposure in many places. I think one house that they put the sensor in, there was some very low level below EPA acceptable levels. It turns out that house used to have lead paint. So there you go. And kind of the intrigue of this story is that the study was commissioned, finished, and then never released.
Wow, that's surprising. And so the whole aspect of having lead near an airport, well, you know, we're working to get unleaded fuel into our general aviation aircraft. And we have a deadline, 2030 is the deadline.
Mm-hmm.
We are demonstrating a Baron right now, a Beechcraft Baron with unleaded GAMI G100 fuel in one engine and regular avgas in the other. But the interesting thing that piqued my mind here, Ian, was that legislation in Colorado, it penalized airports that do not adopt a plan to phase out avgas by January 1st of 2026. Now, that's something that we don't agree with because we want to adhere to the rules and regulations, but it needs to be an orderly transition and not an abrupt change. And this is a state that's trying to make the change versus the FAA, or am I interpreting that incorrectly?
Yeah, right. I mean, so this is like, you know, study be damned. They're going to go forward doing what they want. So there was legislation introduced earlier this month that's exactly right. It would penalize state airports who don't phase out avgas sales by January 1st, 2026, because basically what they'll do is take away state grant money.
Right.
And they would also, I love this, they would add the legislation would add two members to the Colorado Aeronautical Board, expressly excluding pilots.
Excluding pilots, Hangar Talk listeners. Excluding pilots, just reiterating
that. And requiring the governor to, here we go, quote, give priority to individuals who are not trained pilots and who reside directly in the predominant flight path of a high-traffic general aviation airport or commercial airport at which there is significant general aviation activity.
And they're going to be very anti-airport and anti-GA, you would think.
I can't imagine a more blatantly anti-GA.
Yeah, what a skewed group, right?
It's unbelievable.
To add to the aeronautical board. Oh, my goodness. This is, hopefully it's destined for failure, and AFPA is working really hard to get this changed.
Yeah, I mean, to kill this.
That's one of the things that we do behind the scenes, absolutely.
Yeah, so it's one of these, and it's you know, even if you don't live in Colorado, you're like, oh, well, whatever, maybe. But obviously, you know how that works with states. It's like one state starts something and then other states pile on.
Right.
It started with California. Colorado's piling on. It'll just continue. So you got to stay vigilant. And like you said, that is something that AOPA does in the background.
Right.
All right. We'll be right back. Hey, David, I got a riddle for you. How can you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your airplane?
I think upgrading the pilot would be the first clue for that one.
The guy between the headsets, huh? Yeah.
That's right.
All right. That's not what I'm talking about, but I'll give you a clue. It has ADS-B traffic and weather, Sirius XM weather and entertainment, no wires, and it works with 4Flight and Garmin Pilot.
Oh, Ian, I know what that is. It's the Garmin GDL52 Sirius XM portable weather receiver.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And now, believe it or not, the Garmin GDL52 comes with a 3-month trial of Sirius XM aviation weather and a very special limited time $400 rebate. Learn more about all that this receiver can do and the limited time $400 rebate by visiting sporties.com/GDL52. All right, let's go to some good news. Gamma numbers. Love talking about these. You mentioned the intro. Great year. We've got the year end for 2023 numbers now. It was a great year with over 4,000 GA airplanes delivered.
Yeah, for the first time in about 10 years. So that's good. So things are ramping up. Airplane shipments in 2023 compared to 2022 saw piston airplane deliveries increase 11.8%. So that's almost 12%. Mm-hmm. From the same reporting companies. And that's interesting. It was across the board too, Ian, wasn't it? With turboprops going up, piston engines going up, and even helicopters and jets going up.
Yeah, in fact, I'm toggling between the 22 and 23 numbers here. And that's right. I mean, single multi-piston, single multi-turboprop, business jets, piston turbine helicopters, every segment went up. So it was just a fantastic year all around. P. Bunce said in his comments that in addition to workforce shortages and obviously supply chain shortages, they also, you know, he feels like they would have done even better, that those pressures are still there and the backlogs are also growing. So it's overall just an incredibly positive story. And if you go through manufacturer by manufacturer, we'll hit a couple of the high points, but almost everybody had a good year. Almost everybody.
Yeah, you and I looked at a couple of the marquee brands like we like to do, but we know Piper has been doing pretty good lately because they've sold a bunch of airplanes to ATP and elsewhere. In 2022, they delivered 236 aircraft, and they're up to 245 in 2023. So it's about 11 more Yeah. About 10 more.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Not bad.
That's not. And don't forget, an average price of even a single engine airplane is probably $400,000-$450,000.
Yeah.
So that translates to a lot of money right there.
Yeah, that's right. Cirrus, obviously the leader for many years in the single engine world, continues that dominance. Last year they delivered 629 total airplanes. This year they did, 2 years ago, 2022. Last year, 708. So a really significant jump. And really the biggest jump, I mean, jets, my sense is with jets, they're putting them out as fast as they can. They did 90 in 22 and 96 in 23. But man, the SR-22Ts, they went from 280 to 355.
That'll boost those numbers. Well, Textron hot on their heels or ahead of them, depending on how you look at it, because Textron has a huge model line. In 2022, they had 568 total deliveries. And in 2023, that jumped to 618 deliveries. So that's 50 more?
Yeah.
Yeah, almost exactly 50 more. And their billings went from $3.62 billion. I can't even imagine that. It's about the same, $3.62 billion. Mm. So their billings were about the same, but they sold more airplanes. So I guess that must mean they sold more smaller airplanes than they sold
cheap airplanes.
And more expensive airplanes.
Yeah. One down note, one of the very few was actually Icon. They went from 36 in 22 to 33. In 23, so not a big difference. I mean, it's almost it's a couple of units here and there. I tell you who's killing it, though, Pilatus.
What are they doing so well?
Yeah, they did 123 airplanes in 22, and they're up to 149. I mean, it's just amazing. 102 PC-12s went out the door. It's fantastic.
That's really, really good. Well, you know what? Technum is another one that you like to talk about, Ian. And they went up a little bit, too. They went from 209 units delivered in 2022 to 244.
Yeah.
So that's, 20, 30 more. That's looking pretty good, too.
Yeah, that is good. So, it was really good news all around. I mean, I just think, if we could get some more people into aerospace, get them working, and get the supply chain stuff worked out, I think everyone would feel even better about the numbers. But it has been good, and I think people are feeling really good about the future.
Well, it's still difficult for folks to get a good deal on a used aircraft, too.
That's true.
Because the demand, supply and demand is so great. And there's going to be one less Cessna 170B in circulation, because we're going to tell our listeners about how that 170 got given away last weekend as we record this, right?
Yeah, you were there. So if you were hoping to win the 170, if your name isn't Cliff Gursky, I'm sorry you didn't. Cliff was awarded the airplane at the Buckeye Airfare, which was out in Arizona. And by all accounts, just a fantastic winner, a gracious guy. He is a Southwest pilot. So tell us about the ruse, David, because that's always one of the fun parts. How did we get him out there?
It was really interesting. Our flight ops team worked really closely together with Southwest Airlines. Dave Roy, who runs our flight ops department and PIC, went to Embry-Riddle in Prescott with Mel Meadows. Mel Meadows is basically a pilot scheduler in the Phoenix area. And so he was Cliff's, I don't want to say that he's a supervisor, but he helps schedule things. So Mel scheduled the eventual winner, Cliff, to man a Southwest Airlines career booth during the event. Kind of talk to people and chat them up and all. And Cliff was thinking, instead of flying for 3 days, I just have to work one day weekend. That's a win-win.
That's a great airline pilot quote right there.
He was all smiles before he won. It's like
less work.
It was cool.
I love it.
And then Mel escorted Cliff over to the pilot town hall. Mark Baker and leadership talked a little bit about what we're doing, what the future looks like in aviation. And so Cliff was in the audience for that. And then Colin Stagnino, our boss in media, announced that let's everyone go outside. He and Mark Baker said, let's go outside. And someone in this room has won that airplane. We're going to go see who won in the tent. Hmm. So everyone goes outside, And it was really interesting. This was Dave Hirschman's idea. He said that Cliff had a 747 type rating and a DC-3 type rating and suggested that everyone raise their hands. Or if they're a pilot, first of all, raise their hands. So Colin Stagnito jumped on the Tundra tire of this, you know, backcountry beast Cessna 170 and said, all right, everyone who's a pilot, because you have to be a pilot or a student pilot to mm-hmm. win, raise your hand. So a lot of people, you know, raised their hand. He said, all right, keep your hand up if you are a pilot and you live in Arizona. So several hands went down because people were visiting from out of state. And Cliff's hand remained up, along with dozens more. And the next was, okay, if you have flown commercially, keep your hand up. So now we had a handful of hands up. And if you have a 747 rating, keep your hand up. So he had his hand up, and there was another pilot that had his hand up that I ran into the other pilot, Kevin, at Kingman, Arizona, a couple of days later. And he was said, man, I was so close.
Oh, no.
I was like, so guy. Close to this. It's like, there's two of us holding our hands up.
It could be me.
And then right. And then the final contender was you had to keep your hand up if you also had a DC-3 type rating. And Cliff, who flew in Alaska and flew tailwheel airplanes and flew the DC-3,
wow.
had his hand up and just went bonkers when he looked around and saw that he was the only one holding his hand up.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was really super cool. It was great.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. So, yeah, he grew up in Alaska, I guess, right?
He did. And the last general aviation airplane he had, this is a cool part of the story. He had a Citabria, and he sold the Citabria to be able to afford multi-engine lessons.
Oh, my gosh. Way
so
back.
To get that multi-engine rating, he sold the Citabria, and that led him to become a professional career pilot. And he was a super, super excited to be able to have a tailwheel airplane that he could do some more backcountry flying in and do some fishing, do a little bit of flying in the outback, that kind of thing.
That's awesome.
In the backcountry, I do think he will keep this airplane and he will fly it. He already had a hangar set up by the end of the weekend over at Buckeye, Arizona. Absolutely.
That's great. Yeah. So congrats, Cliff, and sorry to everybody else. But there is a new chance.
There is.
So at the show as well, we announced the new sweepstakes airplane. And keeping it in the Cessna family, it's going to be a 182 and a classic 182, a beautiful early 1958 straight tail 182.
Yeah, and it's a 182 alpha model. And Ian, the reason why we're giving away a 182 in the next year and a half or so is that the same make, model, year, and paint scheme was on the very first AOPA Pilot magazine in March of 1958. So it's a turquoise, white, and black straight tail 182, as you mentioned, a straight tail. And that's going to go through a variety of upgrades, but we painted it first this time.
Backwards.
And Ian, I got to tell you, this was a great idea. It really drew a crowd at the Buckeye Airfare. People were just attracted to it. It is a cool looking throwback paint scheme.
Yeah, it really is cool. I love it. And the yokes, you know, we got the turquoise yokes going
turquoise
on.
Turquoise yokes. That's right. That's right. And the turquoise bottom part, underside of the aircraft.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful color too.
It's a great color.
Retro mod is what we're calling it. Yeah.
So I love this because I want to know what the interior shop said when they knew we were coming with a fully painted airplane. They must have been. I bet they weren't happy.
It was interesting. So I got a chance to pick that airplane up from Gus Heisler at Mastercraft Aircraft Painting in Bisbee, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And we did some ground photos there. Nikki Britton is the project manager. She lives in California. She's had a Cessna 182 in her family for decades.
Hmm.
So she's a good project manager for this. But I flew it from Bisbee to Buckeye. And it, as you mentioned, Ian, it had one seat in it. The other three seats were out of the airplane. And listeners can kind of hear me, you know, with a little bit of a rough voice today. It was nothing but yellow fiberglass batting, you know, inside the airplane. So I might have inhaled a little bit of that fiberglass. But the seat that was finished is beautiful. It's a tan seat with a turquoise inset. Mm. And the airplane flew pretty good. For me, it flew straight for me. It needs to have a few more things done to it. The radios were awfully challenging.
Oh, yeah.
But all that's going to get replaced. But my engine was really strong. And the airplane, you know, I would say it flew at around 120 knots at altitude.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
That's about right. Yeah. You know, it's a 0470 engine, constant speed prop, and it jumped off the ground. People who are not familiar with this year model 182 should know that the tail trim operates differently versus later model 182s. The whole tail kind of moves. Mm-hmm. And the airplane is much lighter. It literally jumps off the ground even at higher density altitudes because it's just they're lighter components versus the more recent Skylanes.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have flown one of those, and they are great. I love it. You're right. They're a little slower, right, than the modern ones.
Yeah.
But tons of useful load, and in general, yeah, a little bit lighter. So, yeah, they're nice. This is going to be a fantastic airplane.
It is.
I think people are going to really love it.
Well, people love it already, and I'm telling you, it was a magnet around that air show. And I think for us, for AAPA, it was a great idea to paint it first because it is a showpiece. It's beautiful. And we have budgeted. People are going to ask about this. We have budgeted funds to touch up the paint if we need to. So that's something that people might be asking about. And I'll tell you a little bit more about what's going on. So right now I delivered it from Buckeye to Kingman, Arizona, to Arturo's Interiors. Arturo is well known at Kingman, Arizona, and he had the other three seats completed. Now, it was weird flying an airplane with one seat that's a four-seater. Yeah. I just got to tell you, that was bizarre.
Pilot,
it was like a jump pilot. But he finished the rest of the seats. He was working on the interior of a Beechcraft Baron, Dornier jet, so you know, and a couple of cars, to be honest with you, too. I found out from Colin Stagnito that we're going to have a Garmin panel with a combination of touchscreen avionics, a GT N650XI as the main navigator, and Garmin's new Navcom radio that we talked about a few episodes ago, the GNC215 Navcom, will be the second radio. But we're going to keep the Resto mod kind of looking like the 1950s with several of the Garmin GI275 round dial instruments.
Very
so
cool.
You know, one will be the attitude and airspeed and, you know, basically your flight parameters. The other will give us the directional finding capability and the instrument capability of a horizontal situation indicator, give you a good glide slope and get you in the RNAV. And then the third is going to be an engine instrument gauge. It's going to be all-round dial. So it'll look like it came out of the 1950s, but it'll have modern capability and color screens.
Very cool. Exciting. I hope to get to fly it someday. All right. Hey, David. So actually, you mentioned another 182 pilot. That's Dick Braun.
Right.
The producer and filmmaker behind Flying Boats, which, by the way, you can get on Amazon and I think at a few other places. So after you listen to Dick, make sure to go check out the movie.
Well, thanks for joining us today. We're here at Dirk Braun Gallery, and you are, of course.
I'm Dirk Braun.
So can you tell us a little bit about your gallery and Flying Boat to start out with?
Sure. This is a gallery space on Malibu Road in Malibu, California. And I'd say it's a collection of my photography that is taken during film productions and explorations. We exhibit other artists, too, from time to time. But we have limited edition offerings, different sizes, like the one behind me, which is almost 100 inches framed, and a lot of them were taken during the production of the film Flying Boat, which is my feature film.
And that was a documentary that came out, premiered at Oshkosh, saw it there, very cool.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen it since, I'm sorry to say, but I'm excited to watch it again soon.
Yeah.
What was the process like to make that movie? Because I understand it took several years, and you can tell by watching the movie that it was, you know, this labor of love, and you put a lot of time and energy into it, as did all the people involved, so... What was that like?
Documentary filmmaking is interesting in the way that it's a real discovery in the making. You know, you have an idea for a subject and an idea as to where you want it to go, and it evolves as you're making it. So during the making of this film, you know, I'd have an idea that was sparked by an interview or a shot that I get or uncovering archival footage, and it all kind of just plays to it. yeah, it was kind of a good evolving process until I felt like it was time to get to editing. And then that was a whole different experience.
When you started the movie, did you have an idea of what the finished product was going to be? Or did you just go into it thinking, I want to see where this journey takes me? Or
a little of both. In a sense, it's like this was the film that I dreamed of making and I hoped to make. And it turned out the way I wanted it to. And then, but there's just so many different moments of that were just fortuitous. And like I said, just discovering new things along the way, people, archival footage, shots, and history, and all kinds of things I learned during the making of it. It pushed in a different direction.
So is it your favorite airplane? What inspired you in the beginning to, you know, start out on this endeavor?
It would be safe to say it's my favorite airplane. I'm forever inspired by it. I love that it's just so capable. And by looking at one, you can just, it inspires fantasy and you wonder what you can do with one. And to me, that's just offers just limitless potential and possibility. And that's something that spoke to my imagination. And the more I learned about the aircraft, the more it intrigued me. And it just kind of feels like a fabled, kind of just very special machine. The Albatross has likely been to more places on Earth than any other aircraft. It can take off and land in open ocean, can cross oceans, it can land on land, and also snow and ice. So there's nothing else that can do what this aircraft can do. And it was built with tremendous strength. And it's had so many different lives. It started off as a open ocean search and rescue. It was used by Pan American Airlines. It was the last passenger transport flying boat. They've been used for countless research missions, surf explorations, all kinds of things. So that to me is something really special, and they made four unique subjects for the movie.
Definitely, it is a very unique airplane. And as you mentioned, it has, you know, these incredibly unique capabilities that sort of sets it apart. And on top of that, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful airplane. It's, you know, as you can see in the photo behind you, it's gorgeous to look at. So that definitely adds to the romance of aviation and that sort of golden age that we think of when we think of the golden age of flying. What was your first introduction to this plane? Like, how did this become your favorite plane?
Honestly, it was when I was 18, a good friend of mine introduced it to me, and it just never left me. And I would research it. Like, I'm interested in unique and rare things, and aviation was something I loved, and just kept growing from there. I always thought I kind of just had this idea that I'd make a film about it and kept the pursuit going. Here we are.
So did you become a pilot because of flying boat, or were you a pilot before, or how did that happen?
I started making the film before I became a pilot, and it was just part of the journey in making this film was getting my pilot's license. So that was a special thing to say the least. And I started my training in Connecticut and then finished up in Glenwood Springs in Aspen, Colorado, in the high mountains.
Can you tell us a little bit about the airplane you now own and fly?
It's a 1960 Cessna 182 Charlie, which is a straight-back swept tail they made from 1960 and 61. It's a wonderful plane. It'll land on land and off airport, too.
Do you take it off airport?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, we have some good backcountry strips around here. Do you have a favorite place to go with it?
I like some of the dry lake beds, things like that. And it's exciting, fun to do.
Yeah, it must look nice on film as well. Or do you make the airplane you own now, is that a subject for you for your photography, or is it sort of just something you do?
A little of both. I mean, I've landed on a strip and had my camera with me and enjoyed taking photos of it. Definitely.
That makes sense.
And we've done a few air-to-airs before.
Awesome. Yeah, speaking of the air-to-airs, how did you accomplish the air-to-airs in your movie?
Most of the time, we use drones a lot of the time and helicopters. So camera system on the nose of the helicopter is as good as it gets. And those are fun for, you know, going in on long distance pursuits and filming. Best machine and rig for that. Very sophisticated gimbal with an Arri camera.
Cool.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that you were, of course, along on these. How did you operate the camera during that? Sorry, this might be
in the helicopter, we have controls for the camera and the gimbal inside. So directing that from inside the helicopter.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's a challenge and it's rewarding and it's exciting and it's fun, you know? Okay. Just combining flying and having two aircraft flying in sync together is just it's a beautiful and special thing to do.
Is there a favorite shot or a part of the movie that you're most proud of or that was the hardest to get?
That's a tough one. I love, you know, some of the tropical scenery kind of simulates a dream. And I love going to those kinds of places. Those are the places that, you know, are only accessible by this kind of aircraft. That was really special to do. But then, you know, iconic places when we flew around New York City You know, it's like the significance of that. You know, every aircraft in history has flown that route. And they were also made nearby, this aircraft. So they started there and they've gone all over the world. And it was significant to be able to fly around there.
A little bit of a homecoming.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very exciting.
Is there something that you hope viewers, especially pilots, take away from your documentary?
I hope it inspires aviation and promotes aviation. I think that a love and an interest in aviation is understanding its history and preserving its future and being an advocate for aviation. Beyond that, I hope that it appeals to people that know nothing about aviation and flying and can enjoy something that's unique and uncover a long-lost piece of history.
Yeah, it's not a movie that's just for pilots. It appeals to a broader audience.
Yeah.
What else are you working on right now? Are you working on another documentary, more photography? What's the future hold?
I do photo shoots quite often, and those are, I have an idea and we'll stage those, and those are always fun. So those are my productions and in between film productions. But I'm also a partner in a company called Amphibian Aerospace Industries, and we are remanufacturing the Albatross with twin turbine engines and a modern cockpit. So it's going to be the new Albatross. They're being remanufactured in Northern Territory, Australia, in Darwin. And we're excited to search and rescue missions and exploration missions are in the future.
That's incredible. That's going to be really fun. So the company is based here and you're part of it, or it's based in Australia?
Based in Australia.
Based in Australia and in Darwin.
Yep.
Wow, that's another very historic aviation place.
Yeah, yeah, it's cool. They bought the plans to the Albatross. Mm-hmm. It's such a perfect design that it didn't need anything to be changed. Just updating these old radial engines with turbine, reliable Pratt & Whitney engines and modern cockpit.
That is so cool. Where in the process is that?
Hope to have them an airworthy one this year.
This year, 2024?
Yep. They have a few that are old fuselages that are getting restored and then re-outfitted with the turbine. So we're going to start there and then from scratch.
That is really, really exciting. Let us know when you do that.
I will.
Yeah. Darwin is a pretty unique place. Is the plan to use it for search and rescue or to use it for fun and as a, like, demonstration aircraft at first? Or
we've been taking orders on them. A lot of governments and NGOs are our clients, and they'll be used for search and rescue. And this aircraft can bring supplies and rescue people in a much more efficient manner. You know, a lot of times in places of catastrophes, say natural disasters, an airport is something that has been destroyed a lot of the time during natural disasters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this aircraft can land on the water. Mm-hmm. So we can back into a beach, fill it up, you know, drop off supplies, pick people up, take them out a lot more efficiently than a boat and carry a lot more useful load than a helicopter with 10 times the range. So, yeah, it's very exciting. It's kind of a little, there's kind of a renaissance of the flying boats. They're coming back, third wave. Originally, they were passenger transport, long distance. Pan Am commissioned Boeing and Sikorsky, and they were the first to go transatlantic, transpacific. And then in World War II, they built a bunch of runways for bombers, and the flying boat for passenger transport became obsolete. And then in the 50s, this is when the Albatross was in use. It was helicopter technology that pushed them out. Mm. But nonetheless, helicopters are wonderful aircraft, but they have 10 times less range and a lot less usable load. So this aircraft can really kind of take whatever can be put in it, and it can go anywhere and do anything.
That's really, really exciting that it's coming back as well.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice you would give to any pilots who are interested in becoming filmmakers?
You know, I think airplanes in motion is something that's exciting to watch and to see and to film. So, you know, as a new aviator, it's fun to just hang out at an airport and kind of watch the motion of an airplane. You know, see it taking off and landing. It's be good to get different angles. And I think that whole combination of filmmaking and learning to fly is a good journey in itself. Yeah, I find a lot of pilots like photography and filming kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah, that's true.
And we got our special genre of films that are aviation film. Pioneering flight and airplanes has been a wonderful thing. Something to be appreciated.
Yeah, definitely. And I do think that even the people who don't necessarily want to be pilots appreciate the beauty of flight, especially when captured in video form. So back to your flying. What do you have on the future of your flying plans? Do you want to keep flying? Do you like flying out of Santa Monica? Do you think you're going to stay there or keep the plane there?
I like the idea of Santa Monica staying open. we're not sure of its fate right now, but Santa Monica is a wonderful airport, lots of history, and it's the airport that built LA, and I like being around that. And so many film, you know, so many aircraft that have been in films are there, and that's kind of just special. As far as my flying interests, I love flying boats and albatrosses, and I like old Cessnas, and I mean, all kinds of airplanes. There's so many. It depends on the mission.
Do you have any significant aviation mentors or people that have helped you through it?
So many mentors in aviation. I mean, back to that, just about talking about, you know, love for aviation is understanding the history and being an advocate for aviation in general. I find that there are so many people who are passionate and want to tell you about certain tricks and things to know. And it comes down to the flight instructors, to the people at the ramp, on the ramp. Everybody who's involved in aviation has been an inspiration. And in the making of this film, I'm forever inspired by some of the characters that I had and their pursuits into getting these aircraft off the ground and airworthy again. Just amazing feats, and I'm in awe of it. But I find that I meet aviators all the time that are just awesome and interesting, and they all have different stories. And I like that there's so many different kinds of aviators, you know, and people have different pursuits and dreams and aspirations as to why they fly. It could be for a career, it could be for pleasure, it could be for so many different things. And that's what's just great about aviation in general. Constantly finding new mentors and exciting people. And the camaraderie of it as well, because it's such a solo mission in a way. You know, you're up there flying by yourself, far away from the ground. And then the camaraderie of the aviation community is just, it's special. And I like meetups and air shows, things like that.
Yeah.
Great camaraderie.
Doing things alone together in a way.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's fun because everybody does, you know, we all have our different experiences, which were wildly different, but we still had to go through those same milestones. We've all had those same moments of stress in the air. And so it's you instantly have something to relate to with other aviators.
It's fun to find all different pilots all around the world with different missions. Not to discount the jet, which is romantic and amazing to be able to go so fast and so far. But you're up high and you don't see as much. Kind of the opposite of that is the flying boat. Mm-hmm. We're going low and slow. Mm-hmm. And of course, bush planes and things. But it's an exploration, and you'll be able to see, taking landscapes and views that you had no idea existed. And as you're traveling along, it's a mesmerizing experience.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. And it is the low and slow life, I think, is the life for me. Because there's nothing like looking down and seeing people actually wave up at you. And you're going slow enough that you can actually wave back.
I know. So, special thing.
It is a special thing.
I mean, there's so much emotion that goes through me when you're flying. You know, you're taking it all in. I think about what I am and who I am and where I've come from or where this is, who built this airplane. I mean, there's so many things that to appreciate just how I got up here in the sky. Kind of ride the roller coaster of emotion when you fly. It can be anything from calm and cool and relaxed to, you know, excited to scared and worried, and you have to battle through all those emotions to get to the end and land. So aviation is a good metaphor for life. I mean, it's in, you know, pursuit of, you know, even getting your license takes a lot of effort. And if you want to get it, you have to really be dedicated, and there's no way around it. And it's got to be done the right way, and you have respect for the machine and respect for what you're doing. I think that's a good kind of outlook on life as well. I see a lot of parallels in that. And I mean, you know, if you're in the air, you have to come back down. So, you know, it's, you got to make decisions, and, mm-hmm. you know, life's about decisions.
Totally.
So,
yeah.
You know, are you going to turn around? Are you going to battle through it? Mm-hmm. It's a good decision. Are you going to go or no go? The question you have to ask yourself every time you get in the airplane, if you're going to go or no go. And landing and tying up the airplane afterwards and walking away and looking back at it is a special thing. It's the connection to the machine and the craft is like nothing else. Flying Boat is my feature-length documentary, and it is about a handful of pilots and mechanics that are still flying and maintaining the last remaining examples of the Grumman Albatross, a large hulled seaplane from a long-lost era of romance and adventure. And it's now streaming and available on DVD on Amazon Prime, as well as United Airlines, Emirates Airlines, and Korean Air Flights. The DVD exclusively has a 21-minute behind-the-scenes film as well.
Flying flying boats are interesting. People definitely have a love for those, don't they? It's like a whole sort of crew of people who just have this fascination with them and just love them.
Well, and it needs a crew of people because, to show love and respect for the Grumman Albatross experience. And that's what that whole movie is about, the experience and the dedication of this cadre of folks who just want to keep history alive. That airplane, the one that Dirk was talking about, they resurrected it from Tucson, Arizona, from a boneyard.
Amazing amount of work.
And yeah, folks who are listening want to buy photos, and there are some beautiful pictures. I would suggest they go to DirkBraunGallery.com, and you can purchase these limited edition prints in a variety of sizes. And I've seen them in person. It would be a beautiful addition to any home or hangar.
All right. Very cool. Hey, that's all the time we have. I'm Ian Twombly. Our editor is Austin Hansen.
I'm David Tulis. Don't forget, you can find us at aopa.org/hangartalk or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. We'll see you.
See you next time, Ian.
Hangar Talk from AOPA, your freedom to fly.